You might also find it helpful that there's an outline of sorts in the sheet that you were given when you came this morning. Well, in the week that's just passed, there's been a few mentions of mothers in the news, you might have noticed, as the debate over childcare has continued. And some people have been arguing that stay-at-home mothers don't really need childcare, and they're taking the places of those who are working mothers. And so mothers should be allowed to work without their children, but mothers who stay at home with their children should not have a break from having their children. There's been an attempt to redefine what mothers are and the place that mothers have in some quarters over the last 40 years or so. And it's continuing to rattle on in those sorts of questions that we've heard this week in the news. Of course, there have been people who've been more aggressively assaulting the notion of motherhood in the last few years. People suggesting that mothers aren't important, that you don't really need mothers, that motherhood's not really a fulfilling activity for women, that we ought not to place mothers high on a pedestal. And of course, then there are those who are involved in campaigning for same-sex couples and same-sex adoptions who keep saying, well, you know, you don't need mothers anyway. They're unimportant. But you don't have to read very far into the Old Testament or the New, do you, before you realise the significance of mothers in the purposes of God. I mean, you just had an opportunity at the beginning of our time together to think of five mothers who came to your mind from your reading of the Bible. In the Bible, mothers matter. Adam named his wife Eve because, we're told in Genesis 3, she would be the mother of all living. This woman, Eve, would be important in the Bible story for all sorts of reasons, but not least because the entire human race can trace its origins to her. And the first great deliverer of the Jewish people, Moses, survived the purge of Pharaoh because of the extraordinary plan of an extraordinary woman, his mother. In the New Testament, particularly in the Gospel of Luke, the story really begins with two mothers. Elizabeth, whose son is known to us as John the Baptist, and Mary, the mother of Jesus. Although Jesus himself will speak very, very clearly about a loyalty which takes precedence over all family ties, Jesus doesn't dismiss the value of mothers. Indeed, mothers keep cropping up all through the Gospels. There's the mother of James and John, whose father was Zebedee. There's the wife of Jairus, the mother of the little girl that Jesus raised from the dead in Mark 5. There's Mary, the mother of James, who was with the 11 disciples on the day of the resurrection in Luke 24. See, mothers matter in the Gospels. And yet there's one unnamed mother in the Gospels whose situation provoked a series of remarkable events which led those who witnessed them to proclaim to all in sundry that at long last, now in Jesus, God has visited his people. She's unnamed. After all, her identity is not the issue. She doesn't utter a word. She doesn't make a single contribution to the story at that level. Yet what happens around her, what happens to her and for her, is a trigger for a major new development in Luke's account of Jesus and his ministry. You see, because of these events in Luke chapter 7, John the Baptist will be agitated in his prison cell. He'll eventually send two of his own disciples to ask Jesus, "Are you the one who is to come, or shall we look for another?" Because of these events in Luke 7, Simon the Pharisee will ask to eat with Jesus so that he can work out for himself just who Jesus is and how he should respond to him. The events surrounding the unnamed widow in the village of Nain could not be overlooked by those who heard of them. For all sorts of reasons, they forced the question of Jesus' identity onto all those who heard them. So what really happened that day? What were the events all about? Well, immediately before this incident, if you look back in Luke chapter 7, you'll notice that Jesus healed the servant of a centurion in Capernaum. marvelling at the faith of this foreigner, this foreign soldier. Jesus healed the servant and then headed south. Apparently, as he headed south, not only his disciples, but a huge crowd of people went on the journey with him, all wondering what would happen next. You see, it had been quite a ride since that first Sabbath in the village of Nazareth back in Luke chapter 4. And everybody wondered where it would all be heading. What had he come to do? What would be the great climax of his earthly ministry? The journey south meant passing through the little village of Nain, a quiet little place, destined to be small century upon century. But it wasn't quiet that day. See, as one little crowd came over the hill and moved towards the city gate, just then another crowd came through those gates on a different kind of journey. It was a funeral procession. And it seemed that almost the entire village had turned out to support those who mourned. It was a tragedy which had touched them all. For you know, in a village as small as this one, most, if not all, would have known the man they were now carrying out to his grave. They would certainly have known his family, and they'd known what this meant for them. Now, just a few weeks ago, we've heard of such a funeral procession. In Beaconsfield, a couple of weeks ago, you might remember, the miner who did not survive the disaster was buried, Larry Knight. In that small community, the entire village appeared to come to a halt. Everyone knew what this would mean for his wife and for his family. And so this loss was their loss. And they all came out, you might remember, bikies and all, to escort his body to the grave. For in a small village, every funeral is personal. In a small village, you don't need publicity to draw a crowd for an event like this one. But on this occasion, there was more to it than that. For you see, this was the second tragedy that this family had endured. The woman who walked behind the funeral byre that day had trod that road before. We don't know how long ago it had been, but she had followed another body down that road and through those gates to the burial site outside the city walls. And this second tragedy no doubt brought back all her memories of the first. She'd taken her husband through those gates, and now it was her son. I take it you can imagine the intensity of the emotion, the sense of solidarity that surrounded that funeral procession. It wouldn't have been quiet, of course. The wailing would have begun way back at the house, and it would not have stopped. And so long before the two crowds converged outside the city gates, everyone would have known what was going on. For we read in verse 12, "As Jesus drew near to the gate of the town, behold, a man who had died was being carried out, the only son of his mother, and she was a widow, and a considerable crowd from the town was with her." If we didn't know the end of the story, what would we have expected to have happened next? When the crowds approached each other outside the city gates, the wandering preacher and his entourage just standing off at a distance, perhaps, respectfully allowing the mourners to mourn and the procession to pass by, perhaps. Silent reverence, perhaps. A prayer for those who remained. After all, this is a funeral, and you don't interrupt funerals, do you? What's clear from Luke's account is that everything that happened that day was focused on this widowed woman, this mother who is now burying her only son. Sure, she never speaks. She doesn't ask Jesus to do anything. And yet everything Jesus does say and do in the moments that follow is for her sake. For friends, the moment that changed everything was the moment that Jesus saw her. What does Luke tell us? when the Lord saw this mother, he had compassion on her. Jesus was never a detached bystander. Luke wants us to recognise that Jesus was very, very deeply moved. He understood what this woman was going through. He understood the grief she bore. He understood the way it compounded her grief over the death of her husband. He understood the consequences of that loss, what it meant for a woman in a culture like that to live without either a husband or a son to provide for her. Here, in a moment of time, as it were, is a picture of the pain and distortion and hopelessness and despair of the world which has set itself up in opposition to God. After all, human beings were never intended to die. That's a legacy of the fall from Genesis 3. Human beings were never intended to bury their children. That too is something unnatural that human rebellion has made into a reality. And so here at the town gate is the concentration of a world gone wrong. And in the face of all of this, Jesus resolves to act for the sake of this woman. I wonder whether, as you heard the passage read, you could imagine the tension building as the story went on. It builds with every moment, if you think about it. The funeral procession coming out of the gates, people wailing. This is a very serious moment. It is one of the most serious moments of life. And in the first instance, this man walks over the hill, right up to the funeral procession, and says to the widow, "Do not weep." Do not weep? But if anyone has a reason to weep, it's this woman, isn't it? And if there's any time when weeping is appropriate, surely this is such a time. Don't cry is such an empty exhortation at a time like this. Everyone there that day knew that this woman had a right to weep if anybody did. But that was just the beginning. Jesus headed towards the funeral pyre. You can almost hear the intake of breath, can't you, as he moves towards what we would call the coffin. Leave them alone, you can imagine people thinking. Don't make it any harder than it is. Will somebody please stop him before he makes a mess of this whole occasion? And then he touched the bier. The bearers, we're told, immediately stopped in their tracks. Perhaps the wailing stopped too, as everyone looked on in horror. The supporters of this woman were no doubt preparing to intervene. In a moment, there'll be chaos outside those city gates. If he takes one more step, if he doesn't back off immediately, it'll be on. And then came the words that cut through the tension and took it all to the next level. As Jesus said, "Young man, I say to you, arise." Simple, direct, confronting. From the point of view of those who watched that day, this was undeniably the final straw. It had been bad enough when this complete stranger had approached the grieving mother and said, "Don't cry." He'd been asking for trouble when, by touching the bier, he interrupted one of the most sacred processions in the cycle of life. But now, he'd addressed the corpse. Once again, it's important to realise that no one asked Jesus to intervene in this tragedy in village life. All that he says and all that he does on his own initiative because of his compassion for the woman who'd been left alone and vulnerable by this massive loss. For her sake, he stops the procession. For her sake, he touches the bier. For her sake, he addresses her dead son. She didn't ask. She didn't need to ask. Verse 13, "And when the Lord saw her, he had compassion on her and said to her, 'Do not weep.' Then he came up and touched the bier, and the bearers stood still, and he said, 'Young man, I say to you, arise.' And the dead man sat up and began to speak, and Jesus gave him to his mother." If violence had been about to break out because of the intrusion of this stranger in the very personal event of a man's funeral, it disappeared the moment the man sat up and began to speak. In a moment it was all transformed. Grief and despair gave way to stunned silence and gratitude. The young man was returned to his mother, yet another sign that it was all for her. And all the protests were silenced before they could be uttered. How could this happen? What did it mean? Who was this man? Now, I can't imagine what my reaction would have been if I'd been there. And for something tragic and yet, in one sense, normal in human life, to something entirely out of the normal, something that overturns the normal. Here was something that they had never seen. Perhaps it only vaguely dreamed could happen. Maybe just as they heard the ancient stories read in the synagogue. But now it had happened right in front of them. So close that you couldn't stay a safe distance away. And if this man can intervene in the life of this widow like this, then what will he do in my life? And so Luke tells us, fear seized them all. Quite natural reaction, that one, really. It occurs again and again in the Gospels as people witness what Jesus was doing and saying. This was undeniably an act of God. Only with the help of God could a man do such a thing as this. And so they glorified God, saying, "A great prophet has risen among us, and God has visited his people." And this report about him spread through the whole of Judea and all the surrounding country. You see, this is not really a sentimental story about an act of kindness to a mother. It's not just a feel-good incident in the end, which makes quite good sermon material, especially in the weeks after Mother's Day. Despite the fact, as I said, that everything Jesus said and did was an act of love towards this woman, the real centre of the story lies elsewhere. So you see, these events are meant to remind us of the extraordinary intervention of God in the time of Elijah and Elisha. Just as the healing of the centurion's servant in Capernaum echoes the healing of Naaman the Syrian in the time of Elisha, the raising of this mother's son echoes Elijah's raising of the son of the widow of Zarephath and Elisha's raising of the son of the Shunammite woman. Those who were there in Nain on that day had very good reason to proclaim God has visited his people. The pieces you see are just starting to fall into place. A great prophet has arisen amongst us. And had not Jesus put those pieces together at the very beginning of his ministry? On that day in the synagogue in Nazareth? It was Jesus who connected everything he was about to do with what was done for Israel in the time of Elijah and Elisha. If you go back just one page to Luke chapter 4 and verse 24, we hear this from the mouth of Jesus himself on that day. Luke 4:24, "Truly I say to you, no prophet is acceptable in his hometown. But in truth I tell you, there were many widows in Israel in the days of Elijah, when the heavens were shut up 3 years and 6 months, and great famine came over all the land. And Elijah was sent to none of them, but only to Zarephath, to the land of Sidon, to a woman who was a widow. And there were many lepers in Israel in the time of the prophet Elisha. And none of them was cleansed, but only Naaman the Syrian. When they heard these things, all in the synagogue were filled with wrath, and they rose up and drove him out of the town, and brought him to the brow of a hill on which the town was built, so they could throw him off the cliff. But passing through their midst, he went on his way." Back then, when Jesus had associated what he will do with the work of God through Elijah and Elisha, it provoked the crowd in the synagogue to try to kill him. How dare he speak like that? How dare he make such outlandish claims? But now, do you see, outside the little village of Nain, the parallel was more than mere words. And so what we have here is a great high point in the recognition of Jesus. A great prophet has risen amongst us. And yet when they said those words, the people who saw what Jesus did that day had not gone far enough, had they? For the events that happened there are meant to remind us of Elijah and Elisha and yet take us beyond them at the very same time. For Naaman the Syrian, you see, was healed, that's true, but only reluctantly when he washed in the Jordan 7 times. Jesus healed the centurion's son with a word, simply, instantaneously, with a word. And, as was read for us earlier, Elijah went through an elaborate ritual, stretching himself out on the child 3 times, pleading with God for the boy's life. Elisha would do something similar. But here, in Luke 7, we're told that Jesus simply touched the bier and said, "Young man, I say to you, arise." Short, sharp command, which was obeyed at once by the dead man. We've gone way beyond Elijah and Elisha, haven't we? No delay, no drawn-out procedure, no resistance, not the slightest hint of difficulty. Simply, "Young man, I say to you, arise." Yes, Jesus is a prophet, but much, much more than a prophet. He enters into this mother's grief and he overturns it. And by doing so, he deliberately seizes this opportunity to pull back the curtain a little and show us who he really is and why he came. Those who watched that day told everyone they could that God had visited his people. God's intervened again. He visited us in the past when Moses led us out of Egypt, when the judges rescued us from the oppressors in Canaan, when the prophets called us to remember who we were. But now it's happened again. God's broken in again. And they were right, weren't they? But it was always so much bigger than they could have imagined at the moment. The overturning of grief, the joy, the restoration of relationships, it was all merely a foretaste of what is to come. For Jesus, the great prophet, is always much more than a prophet. When, in the verses that follow, John finally does send 2 of his disciples to ask, "Are you the one who is to come, or shall we look for another?" Jesus replies, "Go and tell John what you've seen and heard. The blind receive their sight, the lame walk, the lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead are raised up, and the poor have good news to preach, good news preached to them, and blessed is the one who's not offended by me." Figure it out, John. All the pieces are there. On that day, outside the village of Nain, a mother overtaken by grief at the death of her only son was confronted with the compassion and mercy of God. We don't know what happened next in her life. We're left to guess the impact of this encounter on the rest of her life. She fades into the background. She's not mentioned again in the Gospels. And that in itself is a clue that, significant as she is, she's not the centre of the story. Neither is her son. At the centre of this story is another son, the only son of the father, who before long would himself die in order to bring about the deliverance of his people. Deliverance not just from grief and death, serious though those things are, but from the cause that lies behind them. As we're told over again in the Gospels, the love of God the Father is shown in the sending of his Son, the one who was God from the beginning, the one who will be seated on the throne at the end, came to die and break through death so that those who trust him might enjoy life as it was meant to be lived. And what this woman experienced that day was just a taste, a tiny taste, of the joy and wonder that God has in store on that day when all things are restored and death and dying are done away with forever. God has visited his people. He's made himself known more clearly, more fully than he did in the time of Elijah and Elisha. Because the one who interrupted the funeral procession that day, who inserted life into a day of death, is the Son who came to demonstrate the love of the Father. And that love will triumph in the end. So start with that grieving but now grateful mother by all means. But let your attention be drawn from her to the one
who gave his Son, so that everyone who believes in him should not perish, but have everlasting life. Why don't we pray together?